You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Every year, red knots fly 19,000 miles from the tip of South America to their nesting grounds in the Arctic and then back, eating millions of horseshoe crab eggs along the way. But these incredible birds now face extinction as a result of global warming. In her latest book, The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and An Epic Journey, Deborah Kramer, a visiting scholar at MIT who writes about science, nature, and the environment, points out that the red knot's fight for survival affects the fate of millions of other shorebirds and ultimately humans. It's published by Yale. It's received the Southern Environmental Law Center's 2016 Reed Environmental Writing Award. I'm very pleased to welcome Deborah Kramer to our show. Hello.
It's a pleasure to be here.
What is a red knot? I'd never heard of them.
Well, I'd never really heard of the bird either until I started looking into this. It's a tiny sandpiper. You can see it along the edge of the sea with sanderlings, other kinds of sandpipers. When you go to the edge of the ocean and you see birds rising when the waves come in, maybe one or two of them might be a red knot.
And how, when you say tiny, what are we talking about?
We're talking about weighing no more than a coffee cup and maybe a little smaller than a robin.
And yet they fly, as I said, 9,300 miles from Tierra del Fuego to the Canadian Arctic and then back. I would think that that would be a little difficult for a teeny bird.
It is difficult, and it's an extraordinary migration. This is one of the Earth's longest long-distance flyers. And they do it with showing a great deal of resilience and a great deal of ability to face tough situations.
How long does it take them to go that distance?
Well, I don't know how you would exactly count this, because in South America, they spend 5 or 6 months in getting fat, resting, and then they begin.
Well, have to get fat so that they can make this journey.
And they have to get fat every time. So they begin moving maybe around February or March, and then they're up in the Arctic by the end of May, the beginning of June.
And how long does it take them to go the complete distance?
Well, they do it in steps. So they'll fly 5 or 6,000 miles, 7 or 8 days, nonstop.
Wow.
And then, at the end of that leg of the flight, they're famished, they're starving, they're tired, and what they need to do then is double their weight again so they can make the next leg.
And are they exceptional flyers? Does that help?
Well, they've, over the years, they've developed a lot of strategies that help them. So,
when you say over the years, what do you
mean? I mean, we're talking about thousands of years. So they can, when they go to eat, for example, they can double the size of their gizzards so they can eat and eat and eat and eat. So they're eating these horseshoe crab eggs or the clams that they're eating. They're just piling them in one or two every second. And then when they're ready to go, they shrink all of the muscles they don't need anymore, and everything gets put into the flying muscles.
In order to write this book, you accompanied the red knots as they migrated. You went down to Tierra del Fuego?
I did. I was really lucky. At every step of the way, I was taken in by the kindness of strangers. In some places, these birds are very easy to see. In Tierra del Fuego, they're on a very remote beach along the Strait of Magellan that's very difficult to get to. But one of the researchers was going to look at them, and she had permission from one of the estancia owners, and we took a very long trip out on that 40-mile-long beach, and we were really lucky that they were right there.
Unlike the birds, you had to walk.
Yes, the birds flew 9,500 miles to get from Tierra del Fuego to the Arctic. I just added up logging in at least 60,000 miles of air time, and I wasn't even counting all of the walking.
You say that you walked 10 to 12 miles a day through snow and ice at times.
That was up in the Arctic.
But you describe this all as exhilarating.
Well,
although also hair raising.
It was both. I was really worried when I went up to the Arctic because it's isolated and remote, and I was with a field team that was really quite experienced. The youngest person on that field team was half my age, or the oldest person was half my age, and the youngest person was a third my age.
But Tierra del Fuego is not far from Antarctica, so weren't you going from cold to cold?
Yes, except that for the birds, it was their summer.
Ah.
But, yes.
They went from summer to summer in both of these
right,
places.
Right, they were following the light going north.
They fly a good bit of the way over the Atlantic Ocean. They go from Guyana in
yeah.
South America to the Delaware Bay area. That's their first stop?
That's another really long flight. Some of those flights are 5 or 6 days without stopping.
Do they always stop in the same place?
In Delaware Bay, they tend to, yes, because they've known, this is another thing that they've developed as they've evolved, which we don't really understand. They know how to find the richest, densest concentration of food. And that, on the eastern seaboard leg of that flight, tends to be Delaware Bay.
What are some of the hazards that they face as they migrate?
They face many hazards. One of the biggest is not getting enough food so they can gain the weight they need to make the next leg.
But don't they also return south during the hurricane season? That
yes.
would mean that they're flying against the weather.
They're either flying against the weather or they have to detour hundreds of miles around it. And it really helps to have a lot of food if you have to make that kind of a detour.
What happened with something like Hurricane Sandy?
Hurricane Sandy was a different sort of challenge for the red knots. Hurricane Sandy destroyed about 70% of the spawning beaches in horseshoe crab spawning beaches in Delaware Bay. So there was a real danger that when the birds arrived, they wouldn't get the food they needed because in Delaware Bay they're eating all those horseshoe crab eggs.
Are they ever hunted?
Yes, they're hunted in South America.
And are they eaten? These little
yes,
birds?
Yes. And
this is like the French.
It's ridiculous, right? They're really, it's only a couple of bites.
Mm-hmm.
And in the Guianas, they are hunted. The Canadian Wildlife Service and the New Jersey Audubon Society are working with all of the hunters down there to suggest that there are other ways of getting the food that they need.
My guest is Deborah Kramer, whose latest book is The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and An Epic Journey. Her previous books include Great Waters, An Atlantic Passage, and also Smithsonian Ocean, Our Water, Our World. Didn't Environmental Canada require that you spend a day at a shooting range to learn how to handle a 12-gauge shotgun before you took the trip to the Arctic?
They did.
What do you need the gun for, or the I guess it's the rifle.
Well, it was a 12-gauge shotgun. The first thing about that was that in order to get the training there, they required me to get a gun license here.
Mm-hmm.
That was actually the scariest.
Did the NRA suggest that you didn't need the gun license?
Of course not. Not only did they not suggest that, I have a Class A. I can carry a concealed weapon anywhere. It's sort of scary. But I went to the shooting range in Ottawa. I was given this 12-gauge shotgun, and I was pretty much told I needed to hit this target before I would go up there because the area around Southampton Island in the Fox Basin has one of the densest concentrations of polar bears in the Canadian Arctic.
And polar bears kill people?
Well, no, but polar bears in the spring when we would be going up there like to be eating baby seals on the sea ice. And as the weather is getting warmer, the sea ice is melting earlier, and the bears aren't getting enough seals to eat, so they're coming ashore, which means they're spending more time where we were and where the researchers studying eiders were eating all the eider eggs.
Where do the red knots lay their eggs in the Arctic?
They lay them a little bit inland. So we were on the edge of the sea, and then maybe about half a mile inland on these ridges, the knots lay their eggs. They're very concentrated in Delaware Bay, these birds, but when they go up to the Arctic, they spread over this wide expanse.
There are no horseshoe crabs up there. What do they eat?
They come up. At the beginning, they're not eating anything. They're burning the muscle from their chest muscles from the flight. And then, hopefully, the eggs hatch right when this gross burgeoning of mosquitoes occurs, and they eat the mosquitoes. That takes them enough to get to James Bay, where they'll eat some clams.
We should invite some of them to eat some of the mosquitoes here.
We should.
You write that, as we point out, the birds eat horseshoe crabs, or the eggs of horseshoe crabs.
The eggs.
Along the way, that's in the spring. What do they eat during their fall migration?
They eat mostly baby clams, tiny clams, and tiny mussels.
Let's talk about horseshoe crabs for a moment. Aren't they one of the oldest species on Earth?
Yes. Right now, scientists think they're about 475 million years old. When I wrote my first book that you mentioned, Great Waters, they were 350 million. Now they're 475 because scientists keep finding older and older ones.
Oh, it hasn't been that long between books.
Oh, it hasn't. But this is one of the oldest animals on the planet.
And they have an odd habit of laying their eggs during full moons and high tides in May and June. Why full moons? Nobody knows?
I don't know. It's a mystery. It's because the tide is very high at those particular times, and they like to lay them up at the high tide line. And then when they hatch at the next set of really high tides, they'll wash into the water.
Would some of our listeners who live in Long Island and New Jersey be familiar with them?
I think they would if they went out to the Jamaica Bay National Wildlife Refuge and went out onto Plum Island. Plum Beach. There's a whole, if you call it the Audubon Society, or there's a lot of people go out on those high tides in the full moons to try to find the horseshoe crabs on Plum Beach.
You write that, I'm quoting, with uncanny precision, within hours of the crab's appearance, the red knots migrating in from 7,600 miles away arrive to feast on horseshoe crab eggs. Does that timing just boggle your mind?
It totally boggles my mind. One, and two, I didn't believe it, really, until I saw it. And I was in Georgia on Little St. Simon's Island. There hadn't been any horseshoe crabs. There hadn't been any red knots. I thought I had picked absolutely the wrong time to be down there. And then that night, all the horseshoe crabs came in. And then the next morning, really early, around 5 o'clock, I went out to the beach, and there were 2,000 red knots there.
What happens if they arrive a day late, if they get held up by the weather?
Well, they wait, but the timing of all of this is really key. Because in Delaware Bay, they have about 10 or 12 days. So this year, for example, there was a cold snap, and the birds were here, but the crabs stayed out in the water. And so not as high a percentage of the birds gained the weight they needed this year.
And they stay there for about 10 days to gain the weight that they need?
Yeah, they can double their weight in 10 days. It's shocking.
You describe the Delaware Bay beaches as an avian Serengeti. How many species are feeding on those horseshoe crab eggs?
Well, there's at least 20 shorebirds. And when in the 1980s, there were 1.5 million birds coming through Delaware Bay. It's a phenomenal thing to see. And you can actually really go see it.
And now?
And now the numbers are much, much smaller. So, for example, in the 1980s, there were 94,000 red knots coming through. This year, there were about 25,000.
The crabs must lay an awful lot of eggs because they have to survive as well, despite feeding all these different birds.
Each horseshoe crab lays about 80,000 eggs, and each red knot needs to eat about 400,000 to double its weight. So 40,000 knots, which is half the former population, need about 16 billion eggs. But the thing is that they don't really eat the eggs that the horseshoe crab lays below the sand. The eggs that the birds eat are the ones that are churned over by the waves or by other horseshoe crabs. So all those eggs would die anyway. So that's, it's a nice, efficient use of eggs.
So that isn't a cause for the 70% decline in the crabs in Delaware Bay since the 1980s?
The cause of the 70% of decline had nothing to do with birds eating horseshoe crab eggs. The cause of the decline for the birds had to do with the take of horseshoe crabs. Humans are taking horseshoe crabs for two reasons, the biggest one being the bait industry. And I try normally to stay calm about this, but there's absolutely no reason for anybody to take a horseshoe crab to use as bait.
Aren't horseshoe crabs also vital to the biomedical industry?
Yes, they are. If you have ever been vaccinated, if you have ever had a heart stent or a hip replacement, or you know anybody who's had any kind of IV line for anything, your life has been made better because of the blue blood of the horseshoe crab. You didn't die of an endotoxin infection because that blue blood is the only FDA-approved test to find that kind of lethal bacteria in our drugs and medical devices.
According to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, most of what we know about human vision was drawn from a Nobel Prize-winning scientist's work with cells that were found in horseshoe crab eyes.
Yeah, the horseshoe crab is an amazing, amazing animal.
Is it because they're so ancient that they kind of like the basis? They have all the things that everybody else got afterward?
Well, that's an interesting idea. Maybe it's that, and maybe it's that what they have endured for so long.
But the biomedical industry claims it doesn't kill the crabs. It simply takes some of the blood and releases them back into the water. Do they survive?
Well, that claim is true, but it's not like when you go and donate blood and then you get juice and cookies afterwards. Up to 30% of their blood is taken, and studies are beginning to show that then when they get back into the water, they walk around dazed, and we're not sure they're able to come back and spawn because they lose their sense of the tidal rhythms. I think it's important to know, though, to keep in mind that even if 30% of the crabs die in the biomedical industry, it's still a lot lower than the 100% that die when fishermen take them to catch other animals that belong on the endangered species list and when they have an alternative.
Didn't Hurricane Sandy wipe out a lot of the crabs' best spawning beaches?
Yes, it did. But the Wildlife Conservation of New Jersey and New Jersey Audubon and the American Littoral Society, those guys worked 24/7 to raise the money to bring in the sand to rebuild those beaches. It was phenomenal. I don't think any of those people slept between the time the hurricane hit and spring.
The endangerment of the horseshoe crab has been something that we've been aware of for a while. In 1998, the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, which represents 15 states from Maine to Florida, developed a horseshoe crab management plan. Has that plan been successful?
Well, no. In New England, the horseshoe crab take is still not sustainable. The population is still in very, very bad shape.
And what happens if they disappear?
Well, first of all, if horseshoe crabs disappear, we're in a little trouble because while there is a synthetic for the endotoxin test, hasn't been approved by the FDA. And if the horseshoe crabs disappear, a lot of shorebirds are not going to be able to eat, and a lot of other animals at the edge of the sea aren't either.
And since 2000, the red knot's population has declined by roughly 75% at key stopovers. What effect would that have on, I mean, beyond the effect it would have on the red knots themselves, what effect would that have on the rest of us?
Well, you know, That is actually a really difficult question to answer, because a lot of what we, when we measure these things, we measure them in terms of the financial benefit to us, or maybe the scientific benefit, and we don't really know. I don't think it would be right to say that we know exactly what would happen if 50 million shorebirds disappeared. But we have evidence that when other animals disappear, there are consequences that happen years later. And if, the perfect example of that would be the loss of the passenger pigeon, which then allowed mice and chipmunks to start eating all the acorns that the passenger pigeons were eating, and then their population skyrocketed, and then the deer ticks started taking off. So these are all repercussions that happen down the line, but if the red knot disappeared today, I couldn't tell you exactly what was going to happen.
What do biologists mean when they talk about asynchronies that result from global warming?
Yeah, I didn't mention that word that often for that reason.
Yeah, but what it's an easy word to stumble
over. It is easy, but what they mean is, what happens if the water in Delaware Bay gets really warm and the horseshoe crabs start spawning really early and the birds are coming from so far away and the spawning happens before the birds get there? That's one thing they mean. Another thing they mean is, what happens in the Arctic if it warms and all the insects hatch, but the birds' eggs haven't hatched yet?
Aren't more than half of all shorebirds listed on the 2014 State of Birds Watch List, which is compiled by the North American Bird Conservation Initiative? What does inclusion on that list mean?
It means that the populations are declining, and we need to figure out what we're going to do to stem this huge decline.
You wrote an op-ed piece for the New York Times headed Silent Seashores, in which you cited 2014 research from Tufts University that warns climate change threatens up to 90% of all shorebirds.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
Well, it's a lot, but, it's a problem.
How often do species of birds go extinct?
Well, in the past, before humans came along, they would become extinct about once every 1,000 years. And in my lifetime, I think there's been at least 25 so far.
We've seen conservation efforts save birds on the brink of extinction. Turkeys, bald eagles, California condors. Can shorebirds such as the red knot and the Eskimo curlew be saved?
I think that we can save all these birds, because it's a whole series of things that are contributing to their decline.
Well,
there's development along the coastline. There's their food, and I think of this now as this trip to the Arctic as a ladder, where now every rung is necessary, and broken ones, further ones, can jeopardize everything. But if we set our minds to it, these animals, as I said, are really resilient. They've been around a long time, and they can come back. We just need to give them some breathing room.
Is this all exacerbated by the fact that there are many political leaders who claim there is no such thing as climate change?
Well, sure it is. But I didn't see that. That has its effect in terms of the money, how much money gets put into all of this. But one of the most inspiring things about this trip was watching all these people along the flyway, overcoming all their political differences, overcoming all their language differences, because they are all committed to saving birds at the edge of the sea. And they will work to do this no matter who is president, no matter what government is in charge, and they just really need the rest of us to help them.
The Narrow Edge, A Tiny Bird, An Ancient Crab, and An Epic Journey is Deborah Kramer's latest book. She's a visiting scholar at MIT, writer on science, nature, and the environment. And her book, which is published by Yale, received the Southern Environmental Law Center's 2016 Reed Environmental Writing Award. Congratulations.
Thank you so much.
And thank you so much for being on our show.
It was a pleasure.